The human mind is basically at its core set up to, of course, help us survive. That's why the brain is there for as a survival tool. And one of the chief components of surviving is what could best be described as a pleasure principle. Basically, it boils down to when we're hot, we look for sources of coolness. When we're cold, we look for warm clothes or open fire or something. When we are feeling hunger, we eat. Thirst, we drink. When we're feeling vulnerable, we seek shelter. Or we also seek the companionship of other people. And so, all in all, it's a good thing that we have this mechanism in place. If we didn't, we wouldn't last very long, quite frankly. Unfortunately, this constant search for pleasure or comfort or ease and this running away from states of discomfort create an additional source of suffering in our lives, because we carry this tendency to always avoid every state of discomfort through to extremes. For example, when we feel the slightest amount of boredom, we immediately seek distraction or excitement. Loneliness, there's a tendency to immediately seek companionship at all costs. When there's a sense of confusion, we look for easy, pat answers very often. When there's anger, we look for an immediate way to release it. It boils down to that we don't like to sit through discomfort. One of the great theorists of the 1960s, a guy named Gregory Bateson, theorized that the entire mind was like a thermostat. And basically what it does is it notices when we're, you know, it basically organizes and takes care of body regulation, heat and food and sleep and stuff like that, breathing. But it also carries this tendency towards the inevitable emotional states in life that we really can't do anything about. No matter how we live, we don't have an inoculation against loneliness or sadness or fear or confusion or boredom or doubt. These are the part of the experiences of being human, to be born into a human body. But I think it's in the overall, just our default wiring that we constantly try to avoid these states. And we don't like to explore them. We don't like to acknowledge them. We don't like to witness them. And this is important to know, because actually the one thing that makes us sort of special as human beings is that we actually have the ability to sit and witness and learn about the way that fear or sadness or anger is working on us, pushing us around. We can actually learn to diffuse emotional states and not act out of them all the time. There's a great neuroscientist, Benjamin Libet, who was one of the founders of consciousness theory, and he basically determined through a set of experiments that before we act, whether out of fear or any other emotion, before we act, before we even have a conscious notion to act, already the muscles that we want to use and the various parts of the body that we're going to use, whether it's the voice or run or the hands, already parts of the brain are sending out signals before we're even consciously aware of making a decision. In other words, unconsciously we've made the decision that we have to act before we even consciously come up with the idea. So unconscious impulses precede our conscious decision making. But he went on to determine that consciousness does have a role. We can't actually consciously create our impulses, but we can override them. There's this period of time before what's known as the muscle potential in the somatosensory lobe reaches the muscles and has us act. There's actually a moment where consciousness can override and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to tell this person to fuck off. I'm not going to, you know, call up this number. I'm not going to send this email. I'm going to pause. Benjamin Libet's follower said he didn't believe in free will. He believed in free won't, as in, I won't do this. So that's important. We actually have the ability to intercede and override impulses, and rather than to act out on them, we have the ability to actually sit and take them apart, component by component, and see how they work. For example, suppose I'm angry. Somebody has said something that I felt dismissive. So there's a lot of components to anger. At first, all I know is that I've got this sense that I've got to say something, tell them to fuck off. How dare they? So the first thing I'm aware of is this sense of outrage in my mind. I'm hearing the story over and over again of how dare that person say that to me. But what I'm unaware of is even before those words started arriving in my mind, the outrage, there's already this physical preparation that I'm going to act out. I'm going to give them a piece of my mind. So what happens? My muscles tense, because even though I'm probably not going to get in a fist fight, my body doesn't know that. It just knows that conflict is going to happen. So these muscles tense. And there's a sense of energy flowing up from my stomach, up my spine. There's a jaw locking, and there's a heartbeat that becomes more and more rapid, because when conflict happens, our heart thinks we're going to have to run or do something. So all of these underlying conditions create the impulse that I've got to tell this person to fuck off. But if I actually put aside the story of the outrage and go into the body and first note, okay, how is anger pushing me around? How is anger telling me to do something? How is anger trying to have its way with me? What is pushing me to send that email? What is pushing me to write that email? What is pushing me to, what do people do? They unfriend on Facebook? Never understood that. But, we're being worked on by our body, by our breath, by the mind jumping around. So there's unfortunate side effects of having a jumpy mind that's always searching for pleasure or comfort, that's always trying to avoid discomfort. The first thing is that all the important skills in life at first require what? They require that we suck at something first before we learn it. If you want to learn the trumpet, you're going to suck at it for a very long time. You're not going to sound like Satchmo or Miles Davis instantly. If you want to learn, you know, meditation, it's going to be boring as fuck for a long time. It really is. I mean, I wish I could. There's some people that just, you know, they're adept. But in most cases, it's rough. It's tough. Exercise is not fun at first. You know, anything worthwhile in life is going to require a steep learning curve. It's going to require discomfort. As I said, I learned to skateboard, right.
Are you sure?
Yeah. The ravages of age. So, Yes, I learned to skateboard when I was 45, which was an atrocity because the willingness to allow 10-year-olds to basically fly by me and laugh at me, which happened all the time. I lived next to a school, and they would wait out for me. Just like, you know, immediately stop what they were doing, the, you know, whatever it is, the ollies or the, I don't know what they call these things. But anyway, they stop and they like, oh, you know, this is going to be great. Now, if there was every impulse in my body to run indoors and just to, you know, immediately just deposit the skateboard in the closet and just to give up. But fortunately, I know how to, I know how to notice when everything in me wants me to give up or wants me to do something unskillful, and I know how to diffuse it. You start with the breath, then you look for the areas in the body, then you try to settle the mind on soothing sensations. You learn how to keep, notice which thoughts are, you know, catastrophizing thoughts, always predicting, oh, I'm never going to learn how to skateboard. This sucks. This is stupid. You look like an idiot. You learn how to spot those thoughts and how to say, thank you for sharing, thank you for sharing. And so, but it takes a lot of, you know, it takes the willingness to work through. Another bad thing about always searching for pleasure is that we tend to stumble upon the same solutions for comfort, and they very often become the things that we're addicted to. When I first started drinking, it was just my way as a 12-year-old to be comfortably around people. But then it became my way of comfortably being alone, comfortably having to write my school papers, you know, comfortably having to deal with my parents. You know, it started as just a strategic way of avoiding social anxiety, and then it grew and grew and grew. And very often the things that we turn to for ease, whether it's TV or food or shopping, sex, workaholism, whatever we dump our mind into to avoid the discomfort of loneliness or fear or abandonment or whatever it is that is a natural stage of life, these things very often become addictive. We also don't learn how to go and discover the underlying roots that lie beneath old held emotions that cause sadness, for example. If every time my stomach feels hollow or tight because I'm holding long-term feelings of sadness over whatever, relationships that didn't work out, family issues, if every time I'm running away from those things, I'm never ever getting to open to these old held emotions. On the other hand, if I focus and keep my mind aware, relaxing the arms and the muscles that tend to be reactive, but the deeper held emotions are in the stomach and in the chest. If I just sit with these sensations, eventually the older stuff starts to arise. So I actually have a fighting chance to get to the source of what's causing this constant sense of disappointment in relationships or work or whatever, what's causing it, and then I can work with that material. But I can't do that if I'm running away from it. If every time I feel this discomfort, I'm fleeing. So, one of the things that happens when we stop, before I say that, also the last drawback of constantly being in search of pleasure is that it creates a really jumpy mind, and the Buddha said that a jumpy mind that can't be satisfied is unpleasant after a while. It keeps us anxious, it keeps us from being able to settle, it keeps us never allowing to truly arrive in life, because we always feel that no matter where we are, there's something missing. When we follow our constant pleasure seeking, whatever we find is never really enough. We're always looking for the next ice cream cone or the next, you know, thing to purchase or the next TV show to watch or whatever. It's never really enough. So when we do learn to finally pause and relax the reactive muscles and sit with the true inner sensations of emotional states and discomfort, one thing we begin to discover is that what the Buddha called anicca, or impermanence. Now, when I say that all things are impermanent, unless you're fairly naive, you'll pretty much agree with me. It's pretty much a no-brainer. But when we say that, it's actually just an intellectual agreement. We all agree that conditions, emotional states, feelings, they're all impermanent. But that's just an intellectual thing. If you're really in a panic attack or feeling anxiety right now, if you're really depressed at this moment, and I facilely say, it'll pass, you'll probably say, well, thanks a lot. Yeah, I know it's going to pass. I just don't know when. And it really sucks right now. So that's not what the Buddha meant when he said that all conditions are anicca, or impermanent. What he meant is that on a moment-by-moment basis, when we focus the mind on areas of the body or the mind, when we focus and we become aware of how sadness is manifesting itself, we'll see that all of its components are subtly changing all the time. There is no solidity to it. There is no sort of lasting state to it. It's an influx. And this is an important recognition, because when we actually sit with sadness or anger, we like the impulse to really, you know, eat something. I really want to eat that donut. And it's right there in front of me. And I'm tired, I don't want to go to work, and there's a donut. You know, so what is, when I really look into the components of craving, I see that there's a slight, that hollowness in the stomach that feels like the emptiness of life, and why am I working at this job, or, you know, why am I having to do this appointment or whatever, then I begin to see how that sensation, those sensations are actually subtly changing. And the sensations of the saliva in the mouth, they're changing. And the way the mind is focusing on the donut, then away, so that then to the donut, then away. It's a show. It's a theater piece. Craving, anger, sadness, loneliness. The feelings of when we're rejected in a relationship, they may seem like at first just a horrible state, but when we really take a moment to investigate it, well, what do we have? We have these arising thoughts of, that person rejected me. I'm never going to find love. That sense of hollowness in the chest, that sense of trembling in the body. So all of these sensations in and of themselves, when we look, we begin to see they're simply this fluid presentation, trying to get our attention, trying to push us to do something. But if we learn to develop the tolerance of sitting and observing the mechanisms of abandonment, anger, whatever, then we actually develop a mind in and of itself that's much more peaceful than the mind that's always searching for pleasure. Because the mind that's always searching for pleasure or happiness, or, I mean, easy happiness, or, you know, comfort all the time, nice sensations, is jumping around. It's always looking for a better thing. But the mind that is simply looking at what's happening right now, that's not a mind that's jumping around. That's not a busy mind. That's actually an inquisitive, very stable, very open mind. It's bigger than any of the emotions, because it's always aware of something more than just the physical manifestations or the thoughts that are pushing us. When you meet monks, they're not people who don't feel anything. It's quite the opposite. They feel everything, but they don't need to act out on it. They simply have this ability to sit with whatever is occurring, to observe it. And they attain this amazing degree of calmness by simply not being pushed around. By opening to what's there, acknowledging it, not repressing it or suppressing it, not acting out on it. It's the third way. And the third way is feeling it, observing it, but always staying larger than it. Always having a bit of the awareness that's pulled back and just viewing everything in, from almost like an impersonal, this is happening, but it's not about me, because every human body has these feelings. It's a slightly detached awareness that feels but also knows that there's always something outside of our emotions, and that's our awareness. That's our ability to observe. That's our ability to say no when impulses are pushing us to act. I was at a retreat many, many, many years ago with a wonderful monk. And at this retreat place, there was this one guy who always liked to pick fights with the monks that were visiting. This guy that was at every retreat I was at. And the monk finished this long, moving talk, and immediately this guy rose his hand and launched into this sort of impassioned attack on everything the monk had been talking about. And I saw the monk like feeling, noticing this, you know, this irritation. But I also noticed him breathing, and I noticed him keeping his muscles, the external muscles, relaxed and feeling though the... I saw the whole thing right in front of my eyes. It was very, very subtle. But it showed me right then and there that the greatest peace is not from, you know, being on a summer grass by the ocean with the breezes, whatever. It comes from a mind that's capable of simply being with everything as it arises, observing it, noting it, seeing how it works, and not being forced to do anything. Additionally, beyond this, what's known as mindful observance or appropriate attention, yoniso manasikara, that achieves peace, there's also metta practice, which is wishing everything that arises well. So greeting all of our experience with just a hello, welcome. Now, it sounds odd to greet your anger with hi. It sounds sort of like almost kind of lame, right? But actually, when we say hi to any emotional state that arises, it doesn't mean we agree or that we're happy that sadness is appearing again, or frustration, or a sense of confusion, what to do with our lives. It doesn't mean that we're thrilled by it, but it also means that we're not going to reject whatever we're experiencing, nor are we going to act out on it. We're simply going to say, hello, okay, I feel what's happening right now. This is what's happening. I can see it. I can note it. This is what I'm going through. I'm going through resentment right now. Okay. Fine. Just that ability to say, yes, this is happening, to greet it, is actually one of the more profound things. It alleviates so much of the suffering in life, which is caused by our resisting our emotional states or resisting what's going on. I was at this another spiritual retreat filled with people from all these different spiritual paths, and there was this one group that I instantly disliked. And they were immediately by the pool. There was a pool, yes. We can swank it up sometimes. They were by the pool every morning. Every fucking morning. And for the first day, I was just in misery. These were people that I just instantly... And my body and everything was pushing me into just thinking and, you know, just concluding that the entire week was going to be a disaster. But on the second day, I just simply, when I saw them, the first thing I did was I just said, yes. 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 Yes, you're here. It wasn't, thank God you're here. I didn't feel that at all. It wasn't, you know, well, I'm an atheist, so I wouldn't resent. Thank, you know, Buddha, whatever. It's not, oh, I'm going to kill you now. It's simply, yes, this is what's going on. And that relieved so much. Because it's not the anger that causes as much of the suffering as the resistance to it, the constant need to flee and find something else that's comfortable, and then being dragged back into the anger, and then trying to find a way out, and then being dragged back in. It's that tug that keeps everything so miserable. So I think I'm going to leave it pretty much there. I think that the idea is that the spiritual path offers us a different way of relating to our experience, which is one where we're not constantly in a program of changing it, but rather we're constantly instead hopefully developing the ability to observe what makes us act, what pushes us, what creates our impulses, what creates our cravings. We're looking at these states and observing them. We're seeing exactly how they work. And this ability to stand back gives us more and more tolerance. It builds up esteem, because the ability to not be pushed around is actually a very worthy state. Everybody else might be acting out around us, but if we're on a spiritual path, we actually have the chance of not being taken up. I remember when after 9/11 happened, there was an enormous amount of anger that was floating around the city, which I spent all my life in, and I, like everybody else, I felt horrified, but I'm really happy that I had a spiritual path so ingrained that I wasn't swept up in this push to channel the sadness and the horror towards anger and vengeance. So that's what we can all do. I thank you.